It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
And always for the right advice at the right time, we turn to Harvell & Collins, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today?
Ben, last week, and we're going to continue discussing it this week, we've been talking about some of these safeguards, if you will, during the course of a trial.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting for our listeners to know that, you know, trials are closely controlled.
Mm-hmm.
They are governed by a very strong body of law that allows either party, the plaintiff or the defendant, and this is after they've gotten to trial, I might mm-hmm. add,
right.
or are heading very close to trial, to assert certain motions for dismissal, if you will, dispositive of the case, disposing of mm-hmm. the case one way or not disposing, and they are granted or denied by the sitting judge.
Mm-hmm.
They are not determined by the trier of the fact, which is the jury. They're determined by the keeper of the law, which is the judge.
Hmm.
And these motions, Wes is going to discuss them with us, but I like to think of them as kind of, you know, they're gatekeeper motions.
Gotcha.
Know, if one party or the other hasn't set forth a claim, if the affidavits, the depositions, the witnesses don't bear out some factual
mm-hmm.
support of the claim, then, you know, the judge very likely will not allow that case just to willy-nilly
mm-hmm.
continue on over to a jury just because lawyers filed pleadings on behalf of their clients
right.
to assert those claims. There is a final stop here, Ben. It's mm-hmm. like Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you land on whatever place and you move back 12 spaces. Okay. I mean, this happens. So let's talk about this more specifically. But last week we talked about these motions, and this week we're going to talk about them a bit more because our listeners need to know that these motions are out there.
Yeah. And they can make or break a case.
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah. Right. So Ben, last week we talked about primarily the 12B6 motion.
Mm-hmm.
This is a rule 12B6 under the North Carolina Rules of Civil Procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what that is a test of the pleadings. You know, when you file the lawsuit, you have to plead it a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
Some claims you can plead generally. Some claims you need to be more specific about, such as fraud claims. If you're going to assert a claim based on fraud, you can't just state that this guy defrauded me. You have
right.
to go into detail about the factual support regarding that fraud claim. But the court would look at the pleadings and make a determination as to whether you have properly pled, meaning stated in writing all of the elements of the particular claim or claims.
Mm-hmm.
Or look to see if there was some defense to those claims on the face of the pleadings that would work to basically undermine your claims so that they would be dismissed under a 12B theory.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a measure of the pleadings. It's a measure of what you have put in your complaint. So we talked primarily, basically 80-90% of the program last week about that 12B6 standard and what you look at with regard to that in the process. Today we'll move on to the Rule 56 standard, which is a motion for summary judgment.
Mm-hmm.
We touched on that last week a little bit and indicated that we would get into that a little bit more this week, and that's what we'll do. So a Rule 56 motion or a motion for summary judgment is not just a test of the pleadings, but rather it also takes into consideration items outside of the pleadings,
mm-hmm.
such as affidavits, which would be a written sworn statement by someone, depositions, Okay, we're at the point now where maybe some deposition testimony has been taken in the case.
Right.
It could be discovery requests.
Mm-hmm.
It could be your sworn pleadings. You can take that into consideration as well. And what the court is doing in looking at all of this, somewhat of a summary of the evidence, summary judgment. It's not a full trial, but it's mm-hmm. a summary of the evidence. The court is, the judge is looking at whether there is a genuine issue of material fact in your claim. And in the event that it's determined that there's not a genuine issue of material fact in a claim, then the court would dismiss that claim based on summary judgment. And it could be if you have five claims, let's say you have a breach of contract, a breach of fiduciary duty, a fraud, an unfair and deceptive trade practices claim, a constructive fraud claim. Could be that the court dismisses all of the claims, for example, but one.
Mm-hmm.
For example, right. all those claims I just went through, they're all a three-year statute of limitations, except for a constructive fraud claim is a 10-year statute of limitations. So let's say, based on consideration of the summary of evidence, the court makes the determination that you filed that case a year too late.
Too late for the others. And then
you still got a constructive fraud claim
because
it's a 10-year statute of limitations. So that would be, you know, somewhat of an example. You know, another example that comes to mind is that when you bring a fraud claim, for example, let's say upon the sale of a house, we have some limited remedies with regard to that because caveat emptor applies. That means buyer beware.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of buy the house based on what you receive because you have the opportunity to inspect, but once you close on it, it's yours.
Mm-hmm. Right.
However, typically in the purchase of a house, we have this document that we see that's called the Residential Property Disclosure Statement, where the owner of the house can make representations about certain aspects, the foundation, the roof,
mm-hmm.
you know, flooding, you know, whatever, homeowners association issues, whatever it may be. And in many cases, one of the only claims that's available once a house is purchased is a fraud claim based on misrepresentations in that document.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bring a fraud claim based on those type situations, you have to prove an element, one element among others, but the one that's the most difficult to prove in many cases as far as those type cases go is reasonable reliance. You have to show you reasonably relied upon the representation. So this is kind of getting into the weeds just a little bit.
Yeah.
But reasonable reliance, our courts have said that if you do not get a home inspection when you buy this house, this particular house, then you cannot prove reasonable reliance because it's recommended to get the home inspected, which would have revealed, we assume it would have revealed whatever the issue is. So that would be a perfect example of a summary judgment.
Right, okay.
The claim is the fraud. You have to prove reasonable reliance. We developed through discovery. There was no home inspection. We have potentially some, maybe an affidavit indicating that in the event there was a home inspection, we would have learned of this roof problem or this foundation problem or this whatever the problem may have been. If you don't do it, our Court of Appeals has said you cannot, as a matter of law, prove your element of reasonable reliance. Therefore, summary judgment on your fraud claim.
Right.
That would be an example there on that.
Yeah, what you're saying is that, yeah, well, you know, the defendant says, well, I didn't know about that, and if they could prove that there was no reason for them to know about it.
Right.
Right, that's what you're saying. So, you know, it's interesting that you bring this up because Tiger Woods just got sued. He owns a restaurant in Jupiter, Florida, and he and his girlfriend is supposedly the general manager of that restaurant, and the bartender that worked there drank too much after work and died in a car crash on the way home. So he's being sued now. For that restaurant allowed him after work to go on a drinking binge, whatever. So whatever the suit is there, the merits, it doesn't matter. But so several parties are named here: the corporation that owns it, the individual owner, the manager, all this.
Right.
Now, would you have a motion somewhere along the line if some could say, well, I don't have anything to do with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah. That would be because we've talked before about casting a wide net. The funnel's large at the beginning. So
yeah.
Are some of those motions for summary judgment about saying, you know, separate, or I guess that's a different motion, but
yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, there could be multiple defendants, and one of the defendants, you know, multiple of the defendants could file a motion for summary judgment, you know, showing that they don't have any liability with regard to whatever the particular issue may be.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, it could be anything. It could be a statute of limitations issue. It could be you mm-hmm. haven't proven an element. It could be.
But it narrows that funnel down.
It narrows the funnel. Yep.
Okay.
Are we going to a break?
Yeah, we're getting ready to go to a break, and we'll come back with more here in just a moment. If you'd like to call in with a question, 247-7282, if you'd like to call in and ask your question of Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law. Welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak, and every Tuesday morning, it's Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. We're talking about depositive, is that
what it
is?
Dispositive.
Like dispose, D-I-S-P-O-S-E, dispose. But Ben, I wanted to comment a little bit about, you mm-hmm. know, our listeners love it when we talk about real life things, and you mm-hmm. brought up the Tiger Woods case, which I know absolutely nothing about, but I've not even heard about it, but this is the point. Yes, it's a good example mm-hmm. because the plaintiff in that case, who is, quote, alleging that Mr. Woods allowed this restaurant to stay open late at night and mm-hmm. provide liquor maybe gratuitously, and therefore the restaurant has some liability about the fact that this gentleman became intoxicated and was in an accident. The point is that, you know, someone somewhere is going to have to present testimony.
Right.
This
right.
has happened before.
Mm-hmm.
There's been warnings about this. There have been other employees that were drinking after hours and, you know, got DWIs, mm-hmm. you know, ran stop signs, you know. I mean, there needs to be some meat on the bones, mm-hmm. you see.
Right.
And if there is no meat on the bones, and this is just completely an isolated circumstance of this bartender
mm-hmm.
staying up late at night, drinking gratuitously, maybe even without permission, okay,
mm-hmm.
to use the alcohol
sure.
gratuitously, then, of course, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the defendant is going to file exactly what we've been talking about in this program. They're going to file a dispositive motion. They're going to say, look, we're sorry this happened, but this restaurant is not liable. There is no indicia. There's no hint of evidence. There's no supporting affidavits, mm-hmm. supporting witnesses that this was an ongoing, you know, in the past kind of thing that occurred. No warnings, no this, no that. And therefore, you know, very likely,
mm-hmm.
if those are the facts, if those become the facts, the judge closes the gate, okay,
there you go.
And dismisses the case in favor of the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that other defendants might still be on the hook. Let's make that clear here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you mentioned, you cast a wide net. There are multiple defendants many times or multiple plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm.
And the process is to narrow down the issues and keep it just as straightforward and as focused as possible for the ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
Narrow the gate,
essentially. So, you know, that's interesting, too. I don't know anything about the case either, but, you know, we talk about Tiger Woods and over-serving and all those type things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple of things come to mind for me is, you know, most states have on their books, in their books, in the statutes, what's called dram shop laws.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these are, and that may have been in the materials that you read about it. Dram shop laws basically.
I didn't see that brought up, but North Carolina has that.
Google it. Basically, yeah. What it's about is it's about making sure you don't overserve your mm-hmm. patrons so they get drunk and cause problems or get hurt or whatever it may be. So it would be interesting, you know, this as from a litigator perspective, whether this claim was brought based on that particular statute in the state of California or wherever this may have been.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into an issue of an analysis of that statute. It probably was brought under that statute, and what comes to mind for me would is that the terminology in the statute. Does the statute indicate that an owner of a business has an obligation, you know, to make sure the patron is not overserved? Or is it the proprietor? Is it the manager? Is it the, you know, who are the parties? Yeah. Okay. And, you know, then that brings into all the other things that we've talked about here. Well, let's look at another definition. If this person was working there and he was the bartender, like you say, is he a patron? Is he someone we have to protect under this statute? The court would weigh that, I think. Okay. Then we talk about the liability, the corporate liability. Well, I'm sure Tiger Woods didn't own this restaurant in his individual name. He owned it probably with others in the name of a corporation or an LLC or some type of entity.
Right.
So is Tiger Woods named individually? Well, if he is, and but he had everything operating properly under the corporate umbrella, then that would be a perfect motion for a motion to dismiss or a summary, a perfect situation for a summary judgment motion. If he had everything done properly, because the defendant would not be Tiger Woods, it would be the corporation.
Right.
So there's lots of different things that you look at here. And if he had organized the corporation correctly, let's say it was one corporation that owned one thing, which is just this restaurant, and that's it. So I'm not excessively, you know, fragmented. I'm not excessively overly funded with regard to a particular corporation. There's just that one business there. That's it. It's not the fortune of Tiger Woods. That's the purpose, obviously, the limited liability of the corporation. So lots of moving parts with regard to that. That would be interesting as to how that would have been pled under dram shop laws, that statute. How does it apply? Liability, where does it extend to? Why is Tiger Woods named an individual party when it was operated as a was operated as a corporation? So lots of moving parts, you know, with regard to that.
But back to the idea of the emotions that may be involved here. Again, you might have multiple attorneys representing all these different entities too. They may not all fold under one. So, right? So you
I mean, I would say that you absolutely do have multiple attorneys, you know, involved, and there could be multiple motions. There could be 12B6 motions right out of the box, which I would think there would be. And then in the event that claims survive, I would think that there would be summary judgment motions, and it could be, you know, multiple parties involved, you know, with this. It could be a federal court case as well. I don't know if it's in state or federal court. Wouldn't matter. The rules kind of work the same across the board. There's a lot of moving parts with regard to where it would be. But, yes, it's an interesting case and brings up a lot of different, you know, legal issues.
So when you're looking at, again, you have multiple parties, is it a severability issue as you're trying to separate the parties? Is that a different kind of a motion, or are you still just looking for summary judgment here?
Well, as far as there being multiple parties, you know, obviously the one party, the one defendant, is only interested in itself getting out of the case.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's right.
So each of these defendants, of course, would have their own legal counsel, and they're probably not concerned about their co-defendant so much. They're more concerned about their own liability. So, but from a plaintiff's perspective, then obviously you're wanting to have, if you can make an argument that a particular defendant is should be in the case, then, you know, obviously you want every party that may be liable for many reasons. You want as many parties who could potentially pay your judgment, compensate you. You want that, but also you don't want to end up having a situation where perhaps one defendant is dismissed early on, and then the other defendants potentially point to that defendant as being the one that was really the. There's a lot of moving parts regard to how these things work.
More to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak and also Let's Talk Legal, talking about dispositive motions and trying to end things, or as we said, narrow that funnel down to eventually may come to trial or may not.
Yeah, and let's talk just briefly. I know we just have 2 or 3 minutes left, but let's talk about the process of going through this. You know, you don't just show up to court and have a summary judgment motion. There's a process you have to go through in order to get to that point. There's a motion that's filed indicating what you're seeking as far as the motion for summary judgment. There's then a briefing process, which is normally pretty extensive, where the parties are gathering up their evidence, their affidavits, their depositions, their written discovery request, all the things that they think that they need in order to either advance their motion for summary judgment or respond to the motion for summary judgment. So it's like getting ready for a mini version of the trial. So the case is then set on the calendar, the trial calendar, the trial court's calendar for it to be heard on the motion for summary judgment. The briefs are then argued in state court, many cases summary judgment motions in federal court. Almost every case is considered only on the briefs, only on the written materials, and not on oral argument as well. So, you know, you could end up spending the better part of a week as an attorney, you know, just pulling everything together, writing the brief, doing the research, providing the cases to the court, getting your evidence together, getting it in a proper summary form so that the court can really sink their teeth into it. Because in many cases, the court is at somewhat of a disadvantage, as I mentioned last week when we were talking about these dispositive motions, because while the attorneys and the parties, especially the attorneys, have spent, you know, hours and hours and hours, if not weeks or months, working on the case, the judges, in many cases, are at a disadvantage because
they haven't spent that time.
They're hearing about the facts for the first time on Monday morning on a motion for summary judgment. And they have 4 other motions for summary judgment to consider that day, you know, in other cases. So the preparation and the kind of breaking it down to the bare facts that are easy for the court to digest is very important. You don't want to confuse the judge, you know, obviously, which is easy to do if you don't do your homework in advance. So very important, dispositive motions, 12B6 motions, summary judgment motions make attorneys sit up in their chair because the result of losing one of those is your claim is gone. The result of winning one of those, you know, on either side is that, you know, obviously you've won your case or won that as it relates to a particular claim or claims. So the preparation with regard to those is very, very important. So, yes.
Again, a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. And if you want to have that work done, you want to call on the folks at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. You can reach them at 726-9050 and go to harvellandcollins.com.